Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams as co-host. Daniel, good to see you.
Good morning, Dr. Paul.
Well, very good. We have a special guest today.
In studio.
In studio, and that's pretty good. And he is a famous person from New York. He's a famous libertarian, Dave Smith, and he's a comedian, and he makes a living doing this. You know, when I was in Washington, and there was a lot of comic going on there. I've told people, you know, that I could never tell a good joke, and if I ran out of things to do, I would just, you know, tell a story about Washington, D.C. Dave, it's great to have you with us today, and I understand you do a podcast called Part of the Problem.
That's so, right, yeah.
Well, it's good to have you with us today.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. I love the show, and I love what both you guys do.
Have you ever been to the city of Lake Jackson before?
I have never been to Texas before.
This
is my first time in Texas, and it's a beautiful state. I'm loving it. Austin was great, Houston was great, and now the beautiful Lake Jackson.
Well,
the capital, I believe.
A few years ago,
exactly.
Daniel moved here to work with me, and the one thing he told me about, and you live in New York.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good story for you. When Daniel moved here, he says, my pay, which was not skyrocketing, goes a lot longer way in Texas than it did in Washington.
Oh, my God.
I'll bet you your cost of living is pretty high where you live.
Yes, and the government's done a lot to make it even worse.
Yeah,
it's very expensive up there. And actually, Gene Epstein, who's a friend of mine and a brilliant economist, he taught me about this, but like in New York City, one out of every three or four buildings are landmarked, and this is another part of why it's so incredibly high.
Wow.
So yes, that is a nice benefit out here.
Yeah. Well, you make a living telling jokes, I guess. Is that mm-hmm. the correct way of saying that? That is a, you know, fascinating, especially if you're a libertarian. You know, if you have to have fun and enjoy doing something, which I'm sure you do, picking on politicians and picking on Washington, as a libertarian, it must be easy. You can pick on Democrats and Republicans.
Well, that's right. And everybody else seems to be so divided into a team, just based on a team, whereas libertarians are on a team based on principle. Like, we're on this team because we believe in this thing. And it makes it a little bit easier to use logic to go at everyone. And, you know, like what you were saying before, I mean, like, comedy and tragedy are very related. And there's something horrific and tragic about government, but there's also something very ridiculous about it. So it's easy to poke at.
Okay, did you become a comedian first or a libertarian first?
I was a comedian first. So I was doing stand-up comedy. I started in early 2006. And so I was doing stand-up comedy in New York, and I wasn't very politically minded. I mean, I was anti-war because of George W. Bush, basically. You know, like, I was in New York when 9/11 happened. He came in and said, we're going to get the guy who did this, and then went into his own adventure. And it was very obvious to me that this was horrible. And so I was kind of, you know, I kind of liked that the Democrats were the more anti-war group. So in my simple mind, I was probably like, oh, we'd be better off if a Democrat was in there. And then I saw one of the Republican debates, and I saw you and Rudy Giuliani going at it. And I said, who the heck is that guy? And I was so compelled because you were making the anti-war argument, not like the way the Democrats were making it. I realized they weren't actually really making the anti-war argument. They were maybe an inch over here, but you went right to the source of the problem. And anyway, so the heart, I mean, really what's hilarious about this is the heart of your argument, which was this controversial argument, which draws huge boos, you know, at the time, your argument was essentially, when you murder people's children, they tend to hate you. Like, this is the argument that you're trying to present, as if it's this radical view that any human being should be able to understand where you're coming from in that. And I found it so compelling. And then I looked into your stuff, and you were talking about the free market. And I had never really thought about that before. But I was so compelled by your anti-war stuff that I was like, let me check this out. Let me read about this a little bit. And I think I wanted to read about it just to understand why you're not right. You know, like, I know this couldn't be correct, so I had to look at, and as then I got lost down a rabbit hole of Rothbard and
now you're
Mises.
Locked in.
And
it's all over. You will never leave us, you know that.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I sort of came at it the same way, but from the opposite. I guess I was sort of, you know, Republican-ish, you know, but I was living in Eastern Europe at the time, and this is when we were about ready to go to war in the Balkans, and all of a sudden I discovered this guy in 1998, who was anti-war and a Republican, and saying great things, you know. So that's, and it was the same with me. Then I got interested in the economics and and other things, and sort of the whole package just starts to fit together perfectly.
Yes, right.
But did you get any stumbling blocks on the way? Is there something you said, well, hold on, I'm not ready to get into that, you know?
Personally, it took me a little while to I'd consider myself an anarcho-capitalist at this point, so that took me a little bit of time, maybe, in that transition. I think there's something about it when... If the whole herd is kind of in the middle and the opinion you have is out here, there's like an inherent fear of that because you're like, well, I don't want to go all the way out here where I might be demonized.
Both sides hate and, you.
Yeah, you know, the more I would read about it, the more compelling it would be. And what really, I think for me, Murray Rothbard's piece, Anatomy of the State, was just like a turning point for me. When I read that, it just kind of all clicked. And I've, you know, like you said, you can never unlearn it. Like I can never go back.
When you're doing comedy and something is so serious, like mm-hmm. we just talked about foreign policy, people die and get killed and they do stupid things. Is it a job to, how do you format that? Because sometimes, you know, you can't make fun of something, you know, because it's so serious, but yet you can still bring it up if you know what you're doing, can't you?
I really think, and I do believe, that there is a real connection between tragedy and comedy, and I think it's about how you approach it. Right. But I think even the most tragic things, lead to comedy. Like my grandfather was, had to flee from Europe, then went back there and fought in World War II. I mean, he had a very, very hard life, but he would make jokes about it. Like, there was just like a thing. And to me, say something like, bombing Iraq. I used to joke about this when Obama announced that we were going back into bombing Iraq. It was after ISIS popped up, and he said we're going back in. And of course, he had been bombing Iraq the whole time, but he announced that we were going back into bombing Iraq. Now, this is, of course, from all of our tragic, absolutely horrible, right. And people are dying. It's awful. But I was able, I went on stage and talked about it, and I go, Obama just announced he's bombing Iraq. And I said, I'm in my 30s. And I said, George H.W. Bush bombed the heck out of Iraq. Bill Clinton bombed the heck out of Iraq. George W. Bush bombed the heck out of Iraq. I was like, and then Obama comes out and he goes, all right, we're going to do something, and you'll never see this coming. And like, I just thought there was something so funny about it. Like, it's like he's like, we're going to bomb Iraq. And I said, isn't everyone in Iraq just sitting there like, yeah, obviously. You're gonna bomb. Like, so this is tragic. I mean, I'm against it, but there still is kind of a... There's funny is an interesting force, and it's just ridiculous and stupid, and we shouldn't be doing it. And I don't know, I like using funny to poke at that.
All right.
Can you walk us through a little bit? I mean, I'm just curious. I'm fascinated sure. by stand-up comics, and I used to watch them a lot more. They seem to be a little more dirty mouth than they used to be when I was young.
Yes.
But, you know, I grew up loving it. How do you go about doing it? How do you think things funny?
You know, I think it's kind of like a mind state that you get into when you're searching for funny and you just kind of keep yourself there. You're absolutely right about comedy getting a lot dirtier. But what's strange, and this is really a bigger thing about like the culture, our culture in America, is that while so like what is considered offensive shifts. So cursing and being dirty or you know, maybe trashing religion or something like that, that might have been considered very offensive at one time, and now that's completely acceptable. Mm-hmm. However, if you were to say something that's, you know, inappropriate about transgender people or something like that, now that's the big offensive thing. So there is this new, but I also find that ridiculous, right? Like, I find that culture ridiculous, so then I try to poke at that. And it's the left particularly is really into like regulating funny now, like, you know, they're like, oh, this was inappropriate. But there's a much, much bigger pool of people who want to laugh at that, who find it ridiculous. So and stand-up is, what's interesting is it's like in a nightclub, and it's like it's kind of this environment where people feel a little bit free to, you know, maybe let a little out that they wouldn't at work.
So you have no trouble poking fun at people who think they're not allowed to be offended.
That's right. Yes.
I mean, that to me drives me nuts.
Oh my God, and truly is terrifying. I mean, at college campuses, the idea that you shouldn't be presented with a challenging view. And I gotta say, from my perspective, and I'd imagine both of yours as well, some of these guys who are going and talking at these colleges who they're like, oh my God, he's so radical. They're like moderates. It's like you're arguing about this guy, the guy Milo Yiannopoulos, who everyone's making such a big guy. He was supporting Giuliani and people like that. You're like, you're not even a radical. Why are they treating you like, I wish you were actually as dangerous as you claim to be, you know?
And don't you have like people like Jerry Seinfeld who says he won't go to college campuses now because it's just, the environment is so challenging, you can't be funny there.
It is amazing. I mean, Jerry Seinfeld said, someone asked him a question about how he didn't have more different minority groups represented on his show, or his show wasn't diverse enough, and he said, I don't think about race, I always just try to get the funniest people. And this was taken as an offensive comment. Like,
really?
This is where we're at, is that the left went, no, that's not good enough. That's still, so look, but what, you know what you're saying, Seinfeld and a lot of great comedians push back against the PC thing a lot. There's something about, it reminds me of Hans Hermann Hoppe's argumentation ethics, but there's something about doing comedy or doing a show like this or anything that you would think that the first prereq is freedom. Like we couldn't do any of this if you don't have freedom of speech.
Right.
Like how could any of us make an argument against freedom? It would just be ridiculous. So I think there's a lot of that with comedy too. I mean, inherently, if you're going to be a stand-up comedian, you have to be for free speech. And then as you've taught me, Dr. Paul, unlike anyone else, it's all one unit. So once you're for the freedom, you kind of have to be for all of it, or you're being ridiculous. You're being contradictory somewhere, and then the challenge is to find that.
Now, I know you've had a lot of interest in foreign policy, mm-hmm. and you've talked about it, and you got interested in libertarianism over foreign policy. But what about the financing of foreign policy? What about this instrument we occasionally talk about called the Federal Reserve? Have you ever made fun of the Federal Reserve?
I have tried to be able to go at the Federal Reserve more and find a way to introduce that. I've not been successful with that yet. I've been able to make fun of the wars, make fun of government employees. Taxation I've been able to really go after, but I'm still working on that. But the Fed, I will say in my conversion process, if you will, after hearing the anti-war stuff, it was the Fed stuff that really started getting me in. I mean, I remember hearing you describe how the Federal Reserve worked and being like, that can't be right. That can't be how it actually works. Whoa. No. This thing does not get to, it's not for profit. There are not private owners that we don't know about. I mean, this couldn't be real. And you look at it and you're like, oh, wow, it really is just like
just
that.
It's bad.
It's, yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about your podcast. And, you know, you do your comedy and that's your main stint, mm-hmm. but you also do this podcast. And I've been, you know,
yes, you have.
Very happy to be on it a couple of times. Tell the audience a little bit about this. Part of the problem.
So part of the problem, I started it around 4 or 5 years ago, something like that. And it at first was just, I think I needed to rant about all this stuff and I needed like an outlet. It was always like my psychology to just get on microphone and be like, what is the government doing to us? And I found these ideas so compelling. And I'm a decent communicator, so I felt like, let me go out and try to give this a shot. And then I've only over the last couple years, I've started getting on the Fox News stuff and getting on more big podcasts. And so now this thing that was just kind of an outlet for me to yell, I've actually got a lot of people listening to it now, and it's helping me go on the road and tour and stuff like that. And, you know, I was able to do the Joe Rogan Experience, which is like one of the biggest podcasts in the country. I know Joe endorsed you when you were running for president, which was great. It was really great to have a big name like that. And so once I went on his, then I got my numbers way up on my podcast. So, and yeah, like I said, I've had Daniel, and you're one of my favorite guests to have on. We have Scott Horton's regularly on the show. A bunch of really great libertarians.
Now, I'm sure you're not too enthused about the war on drugs, but have you dealt with it in any of your monologues?
I do a lot of stuff on cops and the interactions with police, because particularly in New York, there was a lot of, over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of stuff where there's like protests against the police, and there was that really horrific event where a cop got killed, and then they had this government, I should say government shutdown, they had this police slowdown. I don't know if you remember this, but this was really, from a libertarian point of view, really fascinating. So this I talked about a lot, which is somewhat related to the war on drugs. But after this cop got killed, and in New York we have, I mean, our cops they're up there with the worst. I mean, they're like an army, basically, the NYPD. And they leave the world.
You're targeted now. Yeah. You better stay in Texas.
They already know. I'm already on record. Yeah. But they, and so they basically, for about a month, started doing what we might have wanted them to do, and they stopped enforcing these rules. Because basically, this one cop got shot, and then there was a big slowdown, and arrests were down 70%, and they just stopped enforcing nonviolent arrests, and everything was fine. And everything in the city was fine. And then what happened, it was really fascinating, then politicians or the higher-ups started going, realizing no revenue's coming in from these police stations, and all these liberal do-gooders who, you know, they want their government programs at the end of the day. Yeah. And if that comes off of police going and stealing it from minority communities, these communities they claim to champion, you know, that does. Anyway, when I talk about this in my stand-up, I go a little more funny with it. But I always say there's a funny, someone said to me once, and I had a joke about this, and they said the cops work for you. Is that the cops work for us?
Yeah.
And I did a whole joke about this where I say, the cop works for you. Like, let's go test this theory out. All right? Let's go. Why don't you go round up some police officers and start bossing them around? And let's see how this works.
Yeah, that's for sure. No, I think, that the drug thing, and you hinted to this, is that it's a form of nullification that we've gotten into, and I think this is very healthy. It's less enforcement locally, even though they came down hard, and the feds right now, even our administration wants to come down hard. But I think we've been making great inroads on, states just not willing to enforce some of these laws.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's the way it was supposed to be, that states should be able to nullify bad federal laws. So I think that's a good move. But are you an optimist because you have to get people to laugh? Does that mean that everything is rosy? Or how does this work out on your own sense of optimism?
Well, I will say there was a point a few years back where I thought we really were going to do it. And I've been taken back a little bit in my optimism. And I do think that we have hit, look, I never wanted to believe. I kind of liked the idea that electoral politics and this isn't what's so important to us. Government isn't that important. But I will say, since you've left politics, I feel like there's been a little bit of air let out of the libertarian movement, and I almost start to think maybe we need to have somebody. What I'm trying to say is I think you need to run for president again, Dr. Paul. Okay, one more run.
Yes,
I think you can do it. All right. I think 2020 is the year. But I think we've made. You guys have a better perspective on this than me because I came in, like I said, the Giuliani moment in 2007. I've known nothing else except the revolution, the internet, all that. You guys were in it in the dark ages, like way before, when no one cared. I wonder a lot, like how you kept it going all those years. This is when I had you on my show, one of the first things I asked you about, because it's very interesting to me. So I imagine, I kind of look at it and I go, if Dr. Paul can fight all these years, and Murray Rothbard and all these guys who had nothing, they didn't have the internet, what I have is so much more than them, so I should be somewhat optimistic for the future.
Well, we should be optimistic because I think what you're doing is a sign of what's happening with libertarian thinking. He hasn't. He's out there and talking to a lot of people, thousands now that you talk to. And the world changes by a minority of people who have ideas. And you're not up there trying to crack silly jokes. You're up there sending a message, and it's a libertarian message. So. And you need about 8% of the people. So because there's not that key figure or a political movement that you see, I think is relevant. We have a few. We should have. The more the merrier. But ultimately, it is the change of ideas. The fact that you read Rothbard and you're on a stage is pretty fantastic. So those numbers are going to grow. So I think the philosophic revolution is alive and well, and we shouldn't look at that clownish activity in Washington that they seem to never accomplish anything. So and right now, of course, I work on the theory that this thing's coming apart, which you say, well, that's pessimistic. No, it needs to come apart, just like the Soviet system came
apart.
Right,
that's the best thing that ever happened to Russia, right?
Right. So, and that's why people like you out there are talking about it and entertaining people. And this is one thing, I have not been that good at entertaining, but I've always told my crowds that if you're going to get involved, this is serious, you better have some fun. And most of them are college kids, and they seem to be having fun anyway, but they even enjoy believing in something.
No.
So that's why I'm encouraged.
And I think there is a lot of humorlessness in a lot of the libertarian circles, and I think it's so important to have comedy, to be able to laugh. And you always say, enjoy yourself what you're doing. The one thing that I know this from Washington, Dr. Paul, is the other politicians, they don't mind a fight. They don't mind an argument. What they can't stand is ridicule. And so when you ridicule them, when you ridicule a program, when you ridicule what they're doing, that they cannot stand. So do more of it.
Yeah, that's right. Dave, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. This has been great.
It's an honor to be on the show, genuinely.
Best of luck with what you do. And I know you're not part of the problem, but if everybody goes to that podcast called Part of the Problem, they'll find the answer to those problems. So thank you very much for being with us today. And I want to thank our viewers for tuning in today to our program. And please come back soon to the Liberty Report.